From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. As you know, tomorrow's the big day, California's statewide election and the congressional midterms. First hour, it's KPECC reporters on the local House races key to Democrats' efforts to become the majority. Then our political analysts look at the national races. Hour two, it's our voter cram session. Every California ballot proposition's pros and cons in an hour.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. A very big day. Tomorrow, bigger still, Election Day. And of course, we'll be bringing you continuous coverage, what's happening at local polling places throughout the course of the day. Then Nick Roman and All Things Considered in the afternoon, bringing you the very early returns. NPR comes on with its continuous coverage. And then as the evening rolls on, Libby Denkman will be joining me for the returns as they come in after the 8 o'clock closing of the polls here in California. No need to go anywhere else, because this is the place that'll have it first, in depth, with analysis, right here on 89.3 KPECC. So today it's all about, of course, the preparations for tomorrow's big midterm and statewide election coming up in the 11 o'clock hour. Our voter cram session, our experts take you through all 11 ballot measures in numerical order. Grab your sample ballot. You'll hear the pros and cons. That's coming up next hour. But first, as you likely know from listening to KPCC, Southern California, ground zero in Democrats' efforts to flip the House of Representatives. A couple of major factors going on in Southern California districts that have historically been Republican. One of them, shifting demographics as more non-white residents have moved into those areas. That has changed the composition of the electorate. But secondly, you have even longtime Republican districts that supported Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump in the presidential race. That might be a foreshadowing of potential flipping of those seats from Republican to Democrat. But we won't know until tomorrow night at the earliest, maybe not even then, as close as some of these races are projected to be. Joining me is KPECC military and veterans affairs reporter and also our political expert who's going to be with me tomorrow night, Libby Denkman. Libby, welcome.
Hi, Larry. Great to be here.
Let's talk, first of all, moving north to south at some of these races that are fascinating and in play. One of them, a Republican incumbent, Steve Knight. That's Northern LA County, high desert area, portion of Ventura County. He's trying to hang on in a demographically shifting district where Katie Hill, who's been an executive director of a homeless services program here in Los Angeles, she's trying to wrest that seat from him. This looks very close.
It does look very close. The polling is mostly within the margin of error so far, what we're seeing from many different sources in polling, at least. Katie Hill, as you mentioned, this executive from a nonprofit that helped the homeless, fought through a very tough primary to become the challenger against Steve Knight. He's trying to be reelected for a third term. This is one of those districts that has rapidly changed in demographics, Larry. In 2012, it had a majority Republican registration, and now Democrats lead that registration in the 25th district by about 4 points. But again, it's Latinos growing in importance in that district. About 40% of the electorate now is Latino, and that group is historically difficult to predict in midterms. You just don't know if Latinos will turn out. They had a poor showing in 2014 in terms of the last midterm and gubernatorial election that we saw in California. So we just, Katie Hill has been working really hard on the get out the vote effort. She has bilingual call centers trying to motivate that group. But it is a really close race so far in the 25th.
And that's not a big margin for Democrats, given historically Republicans turn out more regularly than Democrats. But this midterm election is that X factor with dissatisfaction with President Trump, the opportunity for Democrats to take the House. It is possible that Democrats turn out at levels that we have not seen in recent elections.
It absolutely is. And groups like Michael Bloomberg's Super PAC has poured millions of dollars into this race. It's possibly the most outside spending of any congressional race in California. And Steve Knight has worked really hard to try to tack to the center on some issues that are major in this midterm. He joined and actually introduced a bill that would protect pre-existing conditions, no matter what Republicans end up doing with the rest of Obamacare in the House and in the Senate. A lot of critics of that legislation say it wouldn't actually secure the care that those pre-existing conditions patients need. But again, he was somebody who says, I agree with this part of Obamacare, Republican who long campaigned against it.
Also with us is Jill Replogle, KPCC Orange County reporter. Jill, it's good to have you with us. Let's move to the 39th district, which straddles three counties, but most of it is in North Orange County. Here, Young Kim, the Republican, hoping to keep it as a Republican seat. Gil Cisneros, the Democrat. There is no incumbent running in this race. And the question is, without an incumbent, which had been a Republican, can Democrats flip it? Jill, share with us briefly what's been going on in the campaigning between the two.
Well, what I think is interesting is you have two non-white candidates, and so there's sort of an interesting play for the Korean vote and also for the Latino vote in that area. Young Kim is a Republican, and older generations of Asian voters tend to vote Republican, but younger voters not so much. And so immigration has been a big issue in the campaign. And, as has happened in other races, both of those candidates have sort of, they're trying to play the middle, because that's really where, these elections might be won or lost, or those kind of undecided middle of the road voters.
All right. Quick thought on this race, Libby.
Yeah, Young Kim has really tried to distance herself, I think, from Donald Trump on several issues, including trade, on family separations. There was a pretty spirited televised debate between the two, Cisneros and Young Kim, where she was, definitely defensive on her support for, for example, a pathway to citizenship for DACA recipients, although she said that they should get in line behind legal immigrants to begin with, because she is a legal immigrant. So definitely somebody who is trying to stake out her own independent identity as a Republican and not hew so closely to the president.
Yeah. This where Ed Royce was multi-term a member of Congress, Republican.
And she was an aide to Ed Royce, longtime aide.
39th district. 45th district. Now, this is largely South Orange County, takes in communities like Irvine, Mission Viejo, Mimi Walters, Republican incumbent, Katie Porter, the challenger, UC Irvine law professor here. Jill, your thoughts on how this is playing out? I mean, it seems to me Walters has been kind of laying low in this race.
Yes, she has not been showing up to, requests to debate Katie Porter. She's been kind of absent. And, there's been a lot of talk about health care in this race. It's been a big issue. But I was floored to wake up on Saturday morning and pick up the Orange County Register and see a front page, one of those fold over front page ads from the Realtors against Mimi Walters. And, that's an expensive ad. And I looked up their campaign donations. They've dropped $3.9 million on this race. And the Realtors used to support Mimi Walters, but she voted in favor of the tax cuts last year, which, could really hit homeowners and also the real estate industry hard. because homeowners are not going to be able to deduct as much of their property taxes. And so they are really going hard against Mimi Walters. And I guess, you know, we'll have to see whether that holds out. But there's just a ton of money going into that race in general.
All right. That's the 45th race here. And it's interesting to me, Libby, because Walters didn't, even a few months ago, seem particularly vulnerable.
Right.
And it just seems like the narrative started shifting.
She's been a rising star in the Republican Party, kind of a moderate pro-business Republican, but, you know, still voted for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, for example, and for the tax overhaul, which she's been hit really hard on. One interesting thing that Katie Porter has done, even though she is an Elizabeth Warren aligned Democrat, very liberal by most people's estimation, she co-wrote a book with Elizabeth Warren. Katie Porter has come out and released ads saying that she opposes the gas tax that was hiked by Democrats in the legislature.
Yeah, she told us that here during the interview.
Yes.
I was really surprised.
Yeah, she said that, you know, in some other interviews that it was because the benefits of this gas tax wouldn't help the 45th district residents that she wants to represent.
Yeah, yeah, that's
but
what
that's definitely
said.
A surprise, considering her, you know, single payer health care support, things that she's really staked out on the far left. But on the gas tax, a local issue, she has come to the center and said that she supports the repeal.
That's the 45th district, South Central Orange County. Dana Rohrabacher, Republican incumbent. Harley Arruda is the Democratic challenger. Arruda was with us just recently on Air Talk with all of these Republicans except Steve Knight. We were not able, unfortunately, to get interviews with them. But the 48th here, there you've probably seen the Earth to Dana ads that have been all over television. Arruda, Libby, has had a tremendous amount of financial support.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a big outside spending district again for Democrats. There's a super PAC supporting Ruda. He also had strong fundraising numbers. Another really bruising primary to get through to become. I mean, that vote wasn't certified for many days to see if Ruda would be the Democratic candidate. The 48th is one of the most reliable Republican areas, that coastal Huntington Beach, coastal Orange County area. This will be a big surprise, too, because they have a healthy registration advantage for Republicans. But Dana Rohrabacher is such an idiosyncratic type of candidate. I mean, this is the guy who even Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, joked is on the payroll of the Kremlin. I mean, this is somebody who has been associated with Russia.
That was a joke.
Really? Yeah, absolutely a joke. But the joke came from a place of people associating Rohrabacher with many, support to end sanctions against Russia, things that just are an odd set of issues to stake a claim on as a Republican. Rohrabacher, of course, very hardline on immigration as well. Something that Ruda has really tried to differentiate himself on. And it'll be interesting to see if, even though this has one of the stronger Republican registration advantages in Orange County, Ruda can eke out a win by being this really pro-business centrist Democrat.
All right. We've got the 49th as well. Diane Harkey, the Republican, against Mike Levin, the Democrat. And the 50th, Duncan Hunter, the Republican, who would have been presumably a slam dunk. Only problem is, he ended up indicted along with his wife over spending allegations of $150,000, a significant amount of money. I don't remember the exact dollar amount.
Misuse of
campaign funds for personal expenses. And have you seen any polling, Libby, in that race?
The 50th district, there has been some polling. Cook Political rates it as a lean Republican. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. It is just a huge Republican advantage in terms of registration there. But again, the federal indictment throws a wild card in. Also, a national attention coming to ads that Duncan Hunter has been running against Amar Campa-Najjar, the Democratic challenger, who's just like 29 years old. I mean, he's a young challenger, used to work in the Obama administration. He is half Latino and half Middle Eastern. And there have been ads against him because of his paternal grandfather being involved in a terrorism act many years ago.
The first World Trade Center bombing, I believe, wasn't it?
I don't believe that was the...
I'll have
to double check what the incident was. But basically, Campa-Najjar says, I was born 16 years after my grandfather died. I disavow any of his activities. activities. And Campanijar himself is a Christian, he says, although the ads that Duncan Hunter is running have associated him with radical Islam. So this race has just become a wild card in terms of these legal issues on the Hunter side, some of the overtones of the ads that Duncan has been running against Campanijar, a lot of outside spending flowing in when Democrats realized it could be vulnerable.
By the way, that dollar amount was $250,000. I grossly understated the amount alleged to have been illegally spent, campaign funds, and Hunter and his wife alleged to have spent on personal matters. We're talking about the congressional races here in Southern California coming up right after the break. We're going to talk about some of the other races nationally, how these Southern California ones fit into the national picture. And of course, we'll talk about the amount of money that's come in on all the statewide ballot measures. Much to talk about. Tomorrow, of course, polls open at 7 o'clock. If you're not voting by mail or if you need to drop off one of your vote by mail ballots at an actual polling place, you can do so. The doors scheduled to open tomorrow morning throughout the state, 7 o'clock. They will be open until 8 o'clock tomorrow evening. That's the time, by the way, that Libby and I will be joining you live on the air as a part of our continuous coverage all night long. We'll interweave NPR's coverage of what's happening nationally, particularly with the Congress, but also some big races like in Georgia, the governor's race, first ever African-American woman, a Democrat who was running there in that race. So many other big races in the Senate as well. Missouri, a big one that looks like a pick'em at this point. We'll have all that coverage for you throughout the day and evening tomorrow. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder, our second hour is the voter cram session. In an hour, we'll take you through all 11 California ballot propositions, the pros and cons. So get your sample ballot out or take notes. That's coming up 11 o'clock right here on KPCC. Let me just correct my misstatement because my recollection was completely wrong about Democratic candidate Amar Campanijar, who's challenging Republican Duncan Hunter. The ads Hunter's been running about Campanijar's grandfather. The grandfather was allegedly involved in the Munich Olympic attack. That was the terrorist attack that the grandfather was alleged to have been a part of, and that's figured in these campaign ads. We continue our conversation along with Libby Denkman and Jill Replogle of KPCC, Democratic strategist Matt Rodriguez, Republican strategist Sean T. Walsh. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. Sean, let me start with you and just, you know, what's the feeling among Republicans nationally? Are they feeling like the odds are stacked against them to hold the House?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Over the weekend and this morning, I did a survey of a lot of folks that I've known for 30-odd years who actually are running campaigns. And there is a glimmer of hope. They think that actually Republicans could potentially hold the House by 5 points. That's if Donald Trump has some sort of dark matter kind of effect, which is not being reflective on the pollster side. Some of the less enthusiastic Republicans think that the House goes to the Democrats by about 7 votes, and then the less enthusiastic by about 27 votes. So people are feeling actually fairly good. I mean, don't be confused by California and the blue coastal states. The economy really is doing very, very well. You know, jobs, not mobs theme has been played across the country, and people feel good about that, number one. And there is an anxiety about not having any controls on the border, and that's having an effect all over the country. So we're not panicking right now. And on the Senate side, if you look what the senators have been doing across the country, you've got a number of senators who are actually walking away from Donald Trump and walking away from their own party on immigration issues. So that's a little telling.
Hmm. Matt, your thoughts about prospects for Democrats taking the House?
Well, I would say first, the specter of 2016 has been hanging over all, I think, operatives in terms of myself, like political operatives, as well as the press, which is it looks pretty good for Democrats. It looks like the House should turn. But 2016, everybody was so 100% sure what was going to happen, and then election night got surprised. So I think there's been a hesitation on everyone's part to say we're sort of looking at the numbers, we're gingerly tracking. Trump is kind of is a unique politician, and it has always felt like we're in sort of uncharted waters. All of that said, if you look at the numbers that have come out, the numbers have stayed relatively consistent. So if you think that the laws of political physics are still going to apply in this election, Democrats have consistently been up anywhere from 7 to 10 points pretty much for months now. Those numbers have been reinforced over the last week or so. Usually late breaking, if you're this undecided at this point, you're probably going to break towards the Democrats. It's not atypical. Usually your base is more energized. You don't have the presidency. The people are out of power. It's very, oh my gosh, things are terrible. We have to change it. So if you look at all the macro numbers, the Democrats should probably win the House. The Senate was always going to be challenging because there's 26 Democratic seats up as opposed to 9 for Republicans. So that was always going to be difficult. My guess would be if you had to come down to it, it's probably a small Democratic win. They probably get anywhere from 10 to 20 vote win in the House, and they probably don't pick up the Senate. But we're going to have to see. There's a lot of people are reading a lot of tea leaves, but we're not really going to know for 24, 48 hours.
Well, I was going to say we may not know tomorrow night because some of these races are wrapped. Like in Southern California, I wouldn't be surprised if all these races we just talked about are not decided by the time we all go to bed late tomorrow night.
And if turnout is high as they think, there's a lot of early votes going. There's just a lot of counting that's going to have to happen, especially, and this is going to be decided probably in the West Coast. And so this is going to take some time. So we may not really know, especially if it's close. You know, if you're talking about a 2 or 3 vote win one way or the other, Republican or Democrat, or 5 seats are the difference, that's, you know, you could have recounts. There's a lot that could still happen. So we could be in for a long couple of days here.
Sean was mentioning the economy, Matt, and I mean, the economic news, at least the numbers, just keep getting better and better. We've got wage growth year over year is the most we've had in nearly a decade.
Yeah.
The unemployment rate hasn't been this low since the post-World War II era.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, so that doesn't always translate to people's lived lives, but the numbers are great. How big a factor in tomorrow's election?
I think it's a pretty big factor. I think there's no question. If you look at Trump's approval numbers and the way he kind of has comported himself and some of the voters that he's hemorrhaging, independents, women, college-educated women, as well as an alienation of a lot of minority voters politically, for a guy who's anywhere from 39% to 43% in terms of approval rating, had the economy not been good, this would be an absolute bloodbath, I think, for Democrats. I think the economy is keeping them in the game in that people are pretty happy. And how could you not be? The economy is doing phenomenally well. Trump takes a lot of credit for it. Politically, he should take credit for it. And he is.
Any president would.
Why would you not? You run away from it when it's bad. And Jimmy Carter went sailing the other way. And Bill Clinton and Barack Obama ran towards it. So I think that it's always hard to pull these pieces out 100%. This is exactly what the good economy means numerically. But I think there's no question it's absolutely had some prophylactic effect for Republicans because Trump is so idiosyncratic, to say the least, as Libby mentioned. So I think that the economy is at least keeping them in play.
Libby.
I did want to mention something about the economy, which is an interesting dynamic versus the national conversation and the state conversation. Because right now, and I think Melanie Mason pointed this out in the LA Times for the first time I heard this, John Cox, the Republican nominee for governor, is trying to argue that California is headed in the wrong direction, the unaffordability crisis, housing issues. And he's really trying to rail and say that there is a crisis happening in terms of the economy in California, whereas he's out of step with this national conversation where Trump is really touting job numbers, touting the direction that the economy is moving in. So in California, the Republican messaging is just simply out of step and out of phase with what the national Republicans are really hoping gets out there.
Sean, your thoughts on that?
Well, look, state races are state races, and this is a midterm election where it's somewhat of a national referendum on Trump, but it's also individual district by district. That's why I have some hope that Republicans possibly can retain the House. The issues are really unique to individual states and individual districts. So in this case, there is real anxiety in the state with regards to affordable housing. I mean, look at the number of ballot initiatives that are on there for veterans housing, affordable housing, rent control. So he's touched on a very sensitive issue in California. Now, I don't think it's enough to get John Cox over the edge, but it's not a bad campaign strategy to play on the anxiety of the kind of those that are getting left behind and then the kids riding around in the tech buses here in San Francisco.
Well, and it's totally legitimate issue to raise that in California there has been some middle class flight and that, you know, as wealthy people, particularly in growing industries like tech, have been able to buy more properties, that's had an effect on the cost of housing overall. So there are areas for him to go after, but Cox is just, he's coming from so far behind. behind in tomorrow's election. This would be the upset of all upsets.
Well, he's had no money. And look, this is the negative. I'm a Democratic. I work on the Democratic side, but I think this is one of the negatives you see of a one-party state. And you've seen it in some of the southern states where it's all Republican. The fact is you get calcified institutions, you get calcified elected leadership. And the fact is this has just been a terrible governor's race. Not for anyone's fault. It's just Gavin was always going to win this thing. The primary was lackluster and relatively mediocre turnout. And now we have real issues in the state we should really be debating, not even so much from a right or a left, from a real public policy perspective, and none of them are being aired at all. Gavin is just talking about resist and Trump and don't be like Trump, and Cox is, he's kind of been a joke from the beginning. He isn't even from here. He ran all the time in Illinois. And so the whole thing has done the voters a disservice because there are real issues around affordability, homelessness, the economy, immigration, even as it relates to the governor's race. And none of that is really getting any kind of airing that the voters deserve.
And Gavin Newsom has really just been campaigning for down-ticket races. He's been crisscrossing the state in his bus, supporting the congressional candidates in battleground districts across Southern California and Jeff Denham in the 10th district. So he hasn't really had to directly address his opponent or even, you know, mention him besides one very short radio debate at KQED. That was the only direct contest between the two in terms of a conversation. I think that, you know, it's clear that there's going to be a conversation, too, about the top two primary and the way that Gavin Newsom was able to game the system in a certain way by running attack ads against Cox. He almost handpicked his opponent in the general, the opponent that he was hoping to see.
Yeah, Jill, in Orange County, you know, typically this would be where the Republican candidate would go for money and events and support. Had there been much going on for Cox in Orange County?
I have not heard of much, to be honest. I see a lot of signs around for him. But I honestly don't know, Larry, I'll be honest.
All right. Sean, let me go back to you. With the economy booming and there's being so much public antipathy for President Trump, would it have been smarter for Republicans to distance themselves from the president so that they could, in essence, run on the economy, their tax cut and other things, and not have to run with the negatives of Trump?
Well, again, district by district, it all depends. In California, yeah, that's the case. And I think if you look at Paul Ryan, he'd prefer not to have President Trump dump on him last week like he did and the potential impact it has for swing districts. But again, I say this and I really mean it. Donald Trump is a bit of a dark matter force. You know he's in the universe. You know he has an effect on the universe. You just don't know what kind of effect he is going to have. And for some people, he will get them over the top. I think for a number of these Senate races, he is actually going to help flip some Senate seats that people are going to be fairly surprised at in Missouri and other states. In the House seats, potentially negative. An interesting thing, Libby's absolutely right with regards to California. A lot of these issues, in my view, were decided in the primary. Once that Mayor Villaraigosa did not win, that changed the dynamics. It was basically a cakewalk for Gavin. The fact that the Republicans in that primary were not able to shut out Democrats in those three districts down there, 49, 48 and the 39th, has changed that dynamic and made these races competitive, too. So, again, some of the spade work Republicans should have done didn't do. And I bet you in many respects Republicans would have been much more enthusiastic for an Antonio Villaraigosa in this election than they are for Mr. Cox.
So. Matt?
Well, can I just mention, you mentioned something about Trump and whether could they have walked away from him. And Sean was saying, well, he's a dark matter, but it's hard to quantify. I'll tell you how easy it is to quantify. If you walk away from Trump, you lose in a primary, typically. I mean, he is a huge colossus striding across the Republican
Even here
party.
In California, you
I think in a primary it was very low turnout. Look at what was it, Rohrabacher? Very low numbers, and even in his own primary, I think you people go against Trump at their own risk. We have a whole thing where everyone is talking about how Trump is terrible, he's this, but like we've seen over and over and over again in his party, people have moved towards him, and that is where the voters are. And if you go against him, there's a huge price to pay. I think it would have been almost impossible, except in maybe very few number of seats, to try to run against him. And to be honest, that doesn't usually work. People tried that with Obama. There were some Democrats who were trying to walk away from him. It's very hard. The bottom line is a lot of these races are nationalized. If you have a D or an R next to your name, you're going to have to let it ride. You do the best you can within the local circumstances that you've got. But in general, you're tied to a lot of what the national conversation is. And Trump dominates the national conversation more than any other politician in our lifetime.
So, Sean, do you think Republicans can pick up Senate seats tomorrow?
Well, I do. I am going to give you a shocking estimate, but I think the Republicans pick up between 4 and 7 Senate seats.
Wow. Really? Wow. You are an optimist for as a Republican. Wow. 4 to 7 seats.
That's hard to say. I can't go that far. It's close. I mean, you look at Indiana, like North Dakota looks like it's gone for the Democrats. You do look at West Virginia, Manchin probably, holds on. But I think you do look at Indiana, you look at Missouri, you look at Arizona, even Nevada. Those are all just very, very close. So that's going to come down to turnout, what has happened here in the early vote. Again, we can make something up. I think those are just too close to call right now. So I think Sean's right. Republicans could have a better day than they think. But I just think it's hard to tell. Some of these races, you're just really not going to know another one maybe for a day or two.
All right. Well, let's open up the phones. You have questions. You want to talk about some of these races, not just a matter of who you're for or against. Less interested in that. I am interested in your analysis of tomorrow's election and why you think things might go one way or the other. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Reminder, of course, tomorrow, Election Day. Coverage throughout the day. We'll even be checking live beginning in Morning Edition once the polls open at 7 o'clock to let you know how things are going. We'll be keeping our ears open, eyes wide for any sorts of glitches along the way so that we can help you understand what voting day is like. Then in the afternoon, NPR takes over along with Nick Roman, and we'll be hearing the coverage of the national races, taking a look at the important Senate, House, gubernatorial races, very big seats that are in play. And then Libby Denkman and I will be joining you coming up starting at 8 o'clock. Once the polls close here in California, we'll be with you throughout the night right here on 89.3 KPECC. And also remind you, in addition to the voter cram session coming up in 20 minutes, our voter game plan can be found at laist.com. That's laist.com. You'll find the voter game plan and can make your way through all of that important voter prep information. Joining me are Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez, Republican and Democratic strategists, respectively. Jill Rep, local KPCC Orange County reporter, and Libby Denkman, who'll be joining me tomorrow night for our coverage. You also hear her reporting on veterans and military affairs. I was curious about what we're going to see in the U.S. Senate race here. Dianne Feinstein, with a very, very big lead like Gavin Newsom has in the gubernatorial race. But, Sean, where are Republican California voters going to go? Are they just going to sit that race out? Or, as has been speculated by some, would they vote for De Leon just because they're so unhappy with Feinstein over the Kavanaugh hearings?
The only way they vote for De Leon is if they don't know who De Leon is. So he is really not a person who's very appealing to Republicans. There may be a little bit of an anger vote for Senator Feinstein in the way that Republicans feel she comported herself during the Kavanaugh hearings. But, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I still believe that Senator De Leon does not win his Senate district in California. I just think this has just been a silent race. Senator Feinstein's gone around and done some very mild photo op types of activities. So I don't think Republicans really factor in here much at all.
All right. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, it's just another kind of lackluster race. Kevin proceeded to the general from the primary, but he barely did that. I mean, he almost was beaten by a complete unknown. She blew everybody away in the primary. Her numbers have not been great. If you look at the poll, there's a lot of undecideds. I think that there I don't know whether she could have been beaten. This would have had to been another alternate universe, 10 months ago or 8 months ago.
Wouldn't
so
it have to
knows.
Be someone with plenty of name recognition?
I think it would have needed some money. I think a couple of things. You wouldn't needed money. I think they probably needed to be from the Bay Area. It's very hard hard for a Southern California person to be. She's a legend up there. Everyone's going to vote for her. Someone need to be able to split the vote up there and then come down here and try to beat her down here. You know, she's never lost L.A. County in her career, much less having lost in the Bay Area. So even though there are more voters down here, you are never going to win by so much down here that you could just get slaughtered up there. So I think she didn't handle the Kavanaugh stuff great. I think she looked very shaky during it. I think you could have maybe had a hybrid if it were a more interesting candidate, a more moderate candidate. She got pushed to the left. They might have been able to go down south and into the Central Valley as well as do okay in L.A. in the L.A. County area. But again, this is all speculation. It doesn't seem like much is going to happen. I ran Kevin's first race for assembly. I like Kevin a lot. So I'm not involved in the race one way or the other. But he's basically, for all intents and purposes, and I say this not to be mean, but he's basically run a state legislative race. I mean, there are state legislative candidates who have raised more than Kevin. And
yeah,
so whatever he was hoping to achieve, I don't know what that was. Not that I expected to win raise $30 million, but this has really been an assembly race. Yeah. It's been weak.
John in Highland Park, I'll say, I think women are going to drive the vote. We're seeing in polling 62% of women voting Democratic. That means a lot of Republican women are looking to vote for Democrats. Sean, your thoughts on the gender breakdown?
Well, I agree. I think that either Republican women vote for Democrats or they don't vote at all. I don't think there's going to be a blue wave. I think if the Democrats take back the Senate, it's going to be what I call blue tornadoes that are going to blow into, you know, suburban borderline suburban urban districts. You know, the thing here, Larry, that I think is really absolutely critical, there has been $5 billion spent in this midterm election. The Democrats are outspending on the Senate side 2-1. You've got Bloomberg who put $5 million into the race with Knight, and then almost $5 million into the Ruda race. The Democrats are outspending Republicans down there by, in some respects, 8-1. I've got people who are doing campaigns in Iowa and Kansas and Illinois, and they're telling me that, you know, these very small, you know, dollar races historically have literally over $1 million in these races. So if the Democrats do pull it off, I think it's going to be by big dollar numbers that have gone in here. And, you know, we're Citizens United here when you've got Bloomberg and you've got guys like Steyer putting in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in these races. So, well, it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see if the money can be enough, in my view, to influence some women voters in some of these races that tend to go more rural and push the Democrats over the top.
Well, I was going to ask you, Sean, so where's the Republican money? But I guess it's probably where it's been, if not more than historically. It's just that the Democratic fundraising has swamped it. Matt?
It's been a huge amount of money. The bottom line is once Trump won, it has polarized the country even more than it was under Obama, which had seen large midterm victories for Republicans. Then they were very energized. They raised a lot of money from the Tea Party. There were historic losses in 10 and 14, and then a shocking loss for Democrats in 16. So they've been gunning to get back ever since. And Trump has provided them no shortage of culture war fodder. Because this is really, you asked about the economy earlier, but essentially Trump has been one long culture war fight. The Democrats have gone all in their culture kind of fights. Republicans are going all in, and they're ending it the same way. You have, you know, like we're talking about the caravan, and Trump is either have the transgender policy that they're changing. So this has become a very large ideological, philosophical, and kind of where are you on the culture wars? Everything is a culture war now, even the economy. And so this is really about where do you stand? And there's a ton of money going in on both sides, but Democrats, it's historic, obviously.
Yeah, and Larry, when you talk about the female effect on this election, the women vote, Orange County is ground zero for a ton of those groups that formed after the Women's March, a ton of the groups that have been getting out the vote, have been holding town hall forums for candidates. They've been out there every single day. Women were at the center of the protests that really bedeviled Daryl Issa ahead of his announcement that he would resign. There's just been a really strong movement of women and especially suburban professional women in Orange County that I think will have a big effect on this election. You also mentioned voters, maybe Republican women voting, for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and also potentially switching and voting in this congressional race for Republicans. I think when you look at a district like the 45th, where Mimi Walters won in 2016 by 17 points, a Republican congresswoman winning re-election, but Hillary Clinton won by 5 points there, there's a strong argument to say there could have been some split-ticket voters who were saying, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton because I find candidate Trump distasteful for
it's
some
an
reason.
Anti-Trump vote.
Right. Right. But in order to provide a check on that vote, I'm going to vote for Mimi Walters, the local congresswoman who I know, who I support her values. It'll be interesting to see if that vote shows up for Mimi Walters and other incumbents, or if indeed it switches.
Well, and we talked about Orange County really being the ground zero for Democrats' effort to flip with all these seats that are in play. And we've talked about the racial ethnic demographic shifts that have occurred there. But there is this other factor of the suburban college educated white women who have historically voted Republican. I mean, those are John McCain supporters. Mm-hmm. And what's going to be interesting, and Sean, maybe you want to weigh in on this, is are Republicans starting to permanently lose that demographic, college-educated, suburban white women because of Donald Trump?
I don't. People who say permanent, I take with a grain of salt. I mean, I've heard historically, you know, the Republicans are done, and I've heard historically the Democrats are done. You know, politics is politics. I do think that we are eroding ourselves with that particular base, that particular vote. But as Matt said earlier, and I think he's absolutely right, you've got to hold your base, and then you've got to get some people in the middle to somewhat support you. Now, is the middle for Republicans conservative Democrats, and is that somewhat conservative independents? Are there enough of them to counterweight the Republican women, the college-educated ones, who are probably likely going to send a protest vote? And that's why I say I think we see blue tornadoes that come and hit districts, and those blue tornadoes will hit very hard in Southern California. But I'm not sure that affects the entire country. Again, so a lot of these women's marches, and they were very, very effective. I mean, I was very impressed with how many people came out for those. But they tend to be in more urban areas. And so, again, I don't know if they cancel each other out with some of the more conservative Democrats who may come across the line based on jobs and based on immigration issues.
We'll continue our conversation. Joining us, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic analyst, Libby Dankman, KPCC host and Veterans and Military Affairs reporter. Libby and I will be with you tomorrow night starting at 8 o'clock. But don't wait till then to tune in, because Nick Roman and All Things Considered and NPR's coverage comes your way all afternoon. And then we start you off with Morning Edition, taking you out to polling locations throughout the Southland. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Coming up, it's the voter cram session, an hour to take you through all 11 California statewide ballot propositions. You'll hear the pros and cons just a few minutes away on KPCC. But we continue with our preview of tomorrow's election. Now, today, one of the big pieces of news, after Sunday Night Football aired an ad that CNN claimed was racist and wouldn't add. NBC got all kinds of criticism for airing it, and said this morning after further review, it will no longer air this ad.
The 7,000 migrant caravan crossing Mexico, marching toward our border. Dangerous illegal criminals like cop killer Luis Bracamontes don't care about our laws. America cannot allow this invasion. The migrant caravan must be stopped. President Trump and his allies will protect our border and keep our families safe. America's future depends on you. Stop the caravan. Vote Republican.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
So not necessarily a surprise that CNN, which has sort of set itself up in opposition to President Trump, wouldn't air it. But Fox News announced this morning it will not air the ad any longer either. Sean Walsh, your thoughts about this and that it has been labeled by critics as racist.
Well, I'm not sure I would go so far as labeled as racist. Is it incendiary? Is it designed to inflame passions and motivate people to come to the polls? It certainly is. Those are the kinds of races you generally races. Those are the kinds of ads you generally see run in House races. But I will tell you that from a polling perspective, this issue has had a very, very strong effect. You know, Kavanaugh matter started to wear off a little bit with regards to passionately bringing Republicans out to vote. But this issue really, really drives Republicans, particularly conservative Republicans, in, believe it or not, in the Midwest, where you wouldn't think that it would. It does. The Tennessee numbers, this type of ad or this particular issue with regards to the migrant caravan has huge, huge effects in that race. And that issue alone may actually take the former fairly popular governor of Tennessee and cost him that race.
What about the morality of the ad, though? And again, obviously, immigration issues, how to deal with the caravan, these are all fair game issues. But characterizing it as an invasion, the cop killer using his example here as a way of saying you need to support allies of the president. What are your thoughts about whether it's right to run an ad like that?
Well, I'm in the Bay Area, and this is a very, very liberal area. And we had the Kate Steinle murder that happened along the Embarcadero in front of the waterfront. We had another family with an MS-13 gang member that mistook the family for somebody else and killed three people in a car. So that's an issue. It's a legitimate public policy issue that's available up here. Is it playing on people's worst and darkest fears? Yeah, I think it is. But with regards to public policy issue, you do have criminal aliens that are acting here. There's not a massive horde, as Donald Trump has unfortunately characterized a whole segment of the public. But those things do happen. And with regards to having, you know, thousands of people coming towards the border who are burning American flags with Nazi stuff on them, granted, that's a minority, but people see that and it affects them from a voting perspective. So is it incendiary? Yes. Is it effective? Yes.
Matt, you think it's effective?
We're going to find out in about 24 hours. I mean, like, the ad is clearly race. I mean, there's a race baiting ad. I mean, that makes the Willie Horton ad look like a Disney commercial. I mean, that is like they've got this. And it's also false. Democrats did not let him in. This guy had come in multiple times. It had been under Republican and Democratic administrations. It was not like the Democrats just wanted them to come in. The caravan is an issue, which I'll get to in a second. But it isn't clear. This guy, Trump has been said there's Middle Eastern terrorists in there. There's all these criminals that are in there. None of that. He's just making all of that stuff up. And I think when you're going to use an entire ethnicity of people, which is basically Mexicans and Central Americans.
Most are Central Americans in Central America.
But he doesn't make any distinction around that. It's just basically that there's a bunch of these people coming down here, and they're all a bunch of criminals, and they're all looking to like destroy your way of life. So I think it's clearly a race baiting ad. I don't know how you can watch that commercial in any other way. I do think the ad does highlight. So we're going to see how effective it is politically. I do think that it does highlight a weakness that Democrats have, which is, and Democrats have had this problem for the last decade or so. You can't just get away with every single public policy issue saying Republicans are racist or everybody's horrible who does this. Like their policy is almost like we welcome people, we want to welcome immigrants, and all that can be true. But you can't. There is going to be, in times of climate change, in times of some of these issues, people moving in different countries. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it here. And there is a question of what is your policy around the border? And that's a problem that Democrats have, is they can't articulate it. They just sort of migrate to this is, pardon the pun, but this is a terrible, this is all racist or this is horrible. You have to let people in. But do we let 7,000 in? Is it 70,000? Is it 700,000? Is it 7 million? And Democrats have not articulated a policy yet. And they're going to need to come up with one if they're going to compete on this issue, because it is a real issue for a lot of voters.
Libby.
I also think, Larry, we need to differentiate what it does on a national stage, what it does in some districts, say in Indiana, versus what it does in California. And an ad like that playing in the 39th district, say a highly diverse district with a large minority and immigrant population, probably not helpful to the Republican candidate there as it would be for a Republican candidate running in another kind of district outside of California.
I do think, Matt, you know, on this issue that the convicted cop killer who they use as the centerpiece of this ad. I think, you know, the supporters of the president, they're going to see it not necessarily that his particular case is laid at the feet of Democrats, but Democratic policies which have not been as robust in enforcing the border, they would argue, allows individuals like this to come in multiple times. I think it's not the arguing that this guy is laid at the feet of Bill Clinton or whatever.
No, although the Trump folks get pretty close to walking up to that line. My point is, this is clearly, it's the same way that they put a face with Willie Horton. It was very much a black blackface to create fear and concern. It wasn't just about Willie Horton. It was about black people in general. That is how it's going to be. Like, I think Republicans knew that was how it was going to be read. I think there's the same kind of thing here. This is how it's going to be. A lot of these Mexicans or Central Americans are gang members. They're criminal aliens. I just think there's a conflation of the two, that if you're of Mexican descent or if you're of Central American descent, that speaks to you in a way that's very offensive.
Sean, quick response to that.
I think he's right. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I think the Democrats need Latino votes. And I think Libby's absolutely right, too. So in California, you know, if you're down in Southern California in one of those races, you're probably just groaning that those ads are running. It's like, you don't need that. You do not need to have Latino votes who tend to skew Democrat motivated to come out in such a tight race. So I think it has benefits to races across the country for some, and in some targeted races, particularly in California, negatives.
All right, gentlemen and Libby, thank you so much. Libby Denkman will be with me tomorrow night starting at 8 o'clock, but tune in all day long for our continuing coverage. And our thanks to Sean and to Matt and Jill as well.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome to the 2018 Voter Cram Session from the California Dream Project. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. The California Dream Project is a statewide media collaboration of the nonprofit news site CalMatters, KPBS San Diego, KQED San Francisco, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, and KPCC in Los Angeles. During this hour, our political analysts and journalists will lead us through each statewide ballot proposition 1 through 12. We'll take them in numerical order so you can follow along on your sample ballot or make notes as we go. Our experts are Caltech Professor of Political Science Michael Alvarez, San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Melody Gutierrez, interim opinion editor of the Southern California News Group Salvador Rodriguez, NPR member station KQED politics reporter Katie Orr, and the director of Loyola Marymount University's Center for the Study of Los Angeles and LMU professor of political science Fernando Guerra. All right. We are going to do this numerically to make it easier to follow, not based on necessarily what's most controversial or important, but we begin with the bond measure Proposition 1. This issues $4 billion in bonds for housing programs and for veterans' home loans. Who would like to start us on that one? Katie, you want to start us on Prop 1?
Sure. I can just tell you a little bit about why we're seeing it in the first place. In the fall of 2017, lawmakers were really dealing with affordable housing. It's sort of like the issue that has surged to the front of the political forefront in Sacramento. And so we saw several bills related to housing, and this is part of that effort, this bond measure that you'll be voting on in a couple weeks.
All right. Sal, you're a libertarian-minded person. As a fiscal conservative, you know, what are fiscal conservatives saying about the bond measures, even if they support the causes?
So it's important to keep in mind that bonds are not free money. Bonds need to be repaid, and whenever you take a look at a bond amount, basically double it, that'll be the total cost to taxpayers. In terms of you take it, you double it, half of it is going to be the upfront money that the bond measures propose and call for. The other half is going to be interest payments on bonds. And so it's important to keep in mind that in a state that has hundreds of billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities as it is, that when you add additional debt, that has to be paid for somehow. And that's something that people have to keep in mind, is that this is not free money. Whatever the intentions of the bond measures are, you're going to end up spending twice as much that you're putting up front.
Well, very important point you raise. The flip side is interest rates, at least for now, are still historically at a low level, even as they are continuing to rise, which does help a bit. Fernando, briefly, your
thoughts? Yeah, I think Salvador is right about not only this proposition, but all the bond measures. But on the flip side, when you take out a mortgage, you basically double that amount. And why do you do that? It's because you're investing in your future and stability, and you need to have that infrastructure. And that's what we're doing here. And the decision really, I don't think, is necessarily about money, although you should take that into consideration. It's such a small percentage of what the California budget is. It's whether you believe in this investment and an investment that government should be making.
All right. Melody, quick thought on Prop 1.
Prop 1, I think absolutely this is a measure that will be interesting to see given the climate right now with housing. I think that will drive a lot of voters, with your heartstrings, so it'll be interesting to see.
As we've seen in Los Angeles City and County, where in recent years we've had two big measures, big ticket measures to help with homeless services, LA County's Measure H and the City of LA, Triple H, designed to create housing for homeless. Proposition 2 is a bond measure which takes some of the revenue from the so-called millionaire's tax. This attacks on high-income Californians to pay for mental health services. This provides $2 billion in bonds for preventive measures on homelessness and to provide housing. Michael, you want to start us on this?
Sure. This is another attempt by the state legislature. The legislature put this one on the ballot to try to deal with our housing affordability crisis that we have in California. It's a bit different than the general obligation kinds of bonds. It's a revenue bond in that there's already a dedicated stream of funding here, and so the funds to pay the bond back will come from the revenue that already exists.
And is there any controversy about taking money that was designed for mental health services and transferring that into a pool of money for housing?
Yeah, absolutely. Melody? That's even the road to get here. This is essentially a bill that was Senator Kevin De Leon's in 2016 and was challenged by a lawsuit saying, you know, that's not the intention of Prop 63, which is the money that is going to be used for this specific bond measure. And so there are people who are saying that you're taking money that is meant for mental health services and now creating a housing program out of it.
And for mental health
for
patients,
mental health.
Right?
Yeah.
And just remember, this was the millionaire tax that we passed, Proposition 63, back in 2004. This is not new money. This is just saying that money, we can now use $140 million of that money to build housing for mental health patients, right? And the other point I want to make is reiterate what Michael said, is that all these initiatives, they're either placed on the ballot by the state legislature or by signatures. And this is one that's placed by the state legislature to change a law that was already voted upon the voters that they cannot change. But they need your permission to be able to spend the money differently. Not new money, but to spend it differently.
Sal, you want to weigh in on this because it is a little different than Prop 1?
Well, there's the same issue that's at play, that this will ultimately cost close to $4 billion. Half of that will go towards these housing programs. The other half will go to interest. Now, one thing to think about is that's over $1 billion that could have gone to mental health services that voters intended to go to mental health services that will instead go to pay off interest on a program that they did not originally support, and that money that was taxed from people, that's now money that's not going to go to mental health services. That's going to go to a brand-new program with results that we don't yet know what that is. So I think that's something that has to be kept in mind, that this is something that's going to be – it's going to end up costing double what it is up front. It's a brand-new program. It's taking money away from services. And this is – the Mental Health Services Act has already been under fire for ever since it was passed by the state auditor, by the legislative analyst office. This money that's already being underused as it is. And so now do we want to take that money and waste half of it on – interest payments.
That's we're talking about Proposition 2, the bond measure, Melody?
Right. I would just jump in there and say absolutely there have been a lot of controversy over the spending of Prop 63, but I would add that the author of that measure, Daryl Steinberg, who's now the mayor of Sacramento, he said that it was always intended to create a program that stabilizes homeless, mentally ill homeless people.
All right. So that's Proposition 2. Next up, the third bond measure on the ballot, Proposition 3, which issues nearly $9 billion in bonds for water-related infrastructure and environmental projects. Who'd like to start us on that? Katie Orr?
Yeah, I can say if you think you voted on a water bond before, you have. This is about the third one. We had one in 2014 that was for $7 billion, and the governor came out very strong for that one. There was one in the spring that we voted on for $4 billion, and that was actually an effort by lawmakers to keep this proposition off of the ballot. They were trying to sort of do an end run around that, but they were not successful. This one would be for watershed treatment, habitat, groundwater management, a whole slew of different water projects. But it's not, we don't see the governor jumping in and supporting this one as we have in the past. There's a feeling that the government, the legislature and the government is not the ones backing this measure.
And do we know how much of this money would go to providing a more reliable source of agriculture water in California versus urban residential use? Has that been delineated to anyone's knowledge?
It seems like most of the water is for people are saying that one of the criticisms is that this is a giveaway to agriculture businesses and that they are the ones that would benefit most from this. And if specific water districts want money for their projects, and they should find a way to fund them. We shouldn't be making everyone in the state pay for projects that will only benefit specific places.
All right. Michael Alvarez, anything quickly to add?
Well, I think
that?
The other thing about this one is, and again, I spent the last couple of weeks reading through this and trying to figure out the details of how this money is going to be spent. And it's really unclear exactly what kind of transparency and oversight we as taxpayers will have with the expenditures under this measure. As I understand it, the money basically goes to agencies. State agencies are going to allocate the funds. And it's really not clear to me exactly how you track the money was one of the concerns I had with it.
All right, that's Proposition 3, nearly $9 billion, water-related infrastructure and environmental projects. The final bond measure is Proposition 4, $1.5 billion in bonds for children's hospitals. Melody, you have anything to say on that?
Yeah. I mean, this one is one of the ones that doesn't have a lot of opposition. It's funding cutting-edge technology for children's hospitals. That's probably a hard thing to run your opposition campaign on. But, you know, their argument is that they treat children from low-income families, they're not being subsidized for some of that care, and that this money is needed for seismic upgrades, equipment. You know, the one thing I would add is that if, like Katie said, if you feel like you've voted on this before, you have. There were two different bonds for similar improvements, $750 million bond in 2004 and a $980 million bond in 2008. So these are things that are going before voters, several times in the last couple
of
years.
And the retrofitting issue is a big thing for a lot of hospitals, I know, because just the cost of doing it to these large facilities is major. Sal, your thoughts on this bond measure?
So to take a stand against children's hospitals, this is one of those measures that sounds good. Who's anti-giving children's hospitals money? Well, I am. this is one point. This is $1.5 billion. This is going to end up costing double that. How about? This is just an idea. How about the state? If children's hospital retrofitting is so important, how about the state just take some money out of its massive budget that it and the massive increases in revenue it has every year, and put some money to children's hospitals retrofitting with existing revenues? They could do that if it wanted to. The state legislature could do that if they wanted to. Instead, we have this measure right here, which is $1.5 billion. That's going to be costing double that. It's going to be at the expense of taxpayers. And when I asked the president of the California Children's Hospital Association if this money was necessary, she said, yes, it would be nice to have. We do a great job of fundraising, but this would be nice and helpful.
All right. This is the 2018 voter cram session from the California Dream Project. Every statewide ballot measure, the pros and the cons, with our expert analysts and journalists. We'll be back with more conversation in 1 minute. This is the 2018 voter cram session. Heard on public radio stations throughout California, I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum, this hour devoted to looking at all the major aspects of each California ballot proposition. We're going in numerical order. If you joined us late, just want to let you know that the entire program is available online at kpcc.org. And you can also take part in the social media conversation about any of the ballot propositions. Just tweet with the hashtag CADREAM. That's for California Dream, this collaboration of nonprofit newsrooms, hashtag CADREAM on Twitter. Let me reintroduce our panelists in conversation. With us, KQED politics reporter Katie Orr, Southern California News Group interim opinion editor Salvador Rodriguez, San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Melody Gutierrez, Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez, and Loyola Marymount professor of political science Fernando Guerra. So we pick right up on the sample ballot with Proposition 5. Now, this revises the process for homeowners who are age 55 and up. Typically, if someone sells a house that they've had for a long period of time and they're paying their property taxes at the lower Prop 13 protected basis, they can at most get one time, one exemption, post 55 to move into another house that otherwise they'd be paying higher property taxes on because it resets. But instead, the basis of their old home is used. Not all counties accept that. It is a one-time dispensation. This, if passed, Proposition 5 would allow that to be used for as many home purchases as one makes post age 55. You take the lower basis with you, and would require that all California counties accept that lower Prop 13 protected tax basis. Sal, let me begin with you on this and get your thoughts on Proposition 5. Obviously, this benefits people that are age 55 and older, but is it too high a price to pay for that?
No, I would agree with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association that this is a measure that is completely consistent with the spirit of Proposition 13. It protects older taxpayers, older property owners, and it allows them to move without facing crippling increases in property taxes.
All right, Fernando, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, it's hard to be objective on this one. This is the continuing assault on the younger generation. It's the continuing transfer of wealth from the young to the older. It will negatively impact K through 12 schools. This is basically one generation telling the other, you don't vote, so we're going to take advantage of you. This is basically as bad as the Trump tax cuts were in terms of the impact that it has. And to me, it's almost an offensive type of an issue.
So what about the counter argument, though, Fernando, that this would lead to more older Californians moving more frequently? Because they only get one exemption that keeps people in place, that this would open up housing to younger buyers potentially because older homeowners wouldn't be so fearful of downsizing.
Okay, there's absolutely no – that's a great hypothesis. There's absolutely no data that that actually occurs. And think about what we're talking about. We're talking about an older homeowner making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 and we on the sale of the home, and we still want to subsidize them to go and move somewhere else. That, to me, is ridiculous. I mean, yes, it might lead to maybe more people moving, but minuscule. The potential impact on the California budget in K through 12 is over $1 billion. By giving that $1 billion from children to older folks so they continue to enjoy a high standard of living.
Katie Orr.
Yeah, just to that point, I think that is one of the big concerns that cities and counties have is that they will lose out on a lot of tax revenue. And you see firefighters coming out against this, talking about how they're going to, you know, they'll lose property tax revenue. And, you know, if they lose property tax revenue, they'll probably look for other ways to make it up. So I don't know that we would necessarily, you know, citizens would feel the strain in other ways if they lost property tax revenue. The other thing to point out is that it's the realtors that are really backing this measure. And so there is some criticism that it's a play by realtors to get more business for them. So.
Of course, what may be in the best interest of realtors could conceivably also aid the housing market if, again, more people are willing to downsize, opening up properties that then would be reset for people under age 55 to the higher property tax basis. So, but I understand your point. Yep. For now, there's no evidence that would. Michael.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that again, this is one of these arguments about affordability. We have this housing affordability crisis in California. We'll talk about this later with some of the other ballot measures. I just really have trouble seeing how this is going to create supply. Right. When you think about the crisis is really a crisis of supply. We don't have enough housing. As I think Fernando said, it's not clear to me this is going to generate an additional amount of supply. And it's going to take about $1 billion a year away from cities and schools.
All right. Melody, a quick thought on this?
I think one of the interesting things is just that there is no revenue or income basis for this. And so I think there's a lot of effort to paint that this will affect grandma and grandpa, but you aren't looking at the income basis of who's going to be moving.
And Sal, quick final thought on this.
Yeah, so I appreciate the concern that's expressed about the potential $1 billion in revenue loss a year. That's been argued by the California Teachers Association and other public sector unions that have opposed this on the grounds that it'll mean less money for them. I would love it if they had that same concern about the rising pension obligations every year that's hitting every community across the state, including the state government. You're talking about billions and billions of dollars of increases every single year to pay for a transfer of wealth from the younger to the older generations.
But the $1 billion number comes from the legislative analyst.
Okay? Yes.
That's the legislative analyst, not anybody else. That's where that number comes from.
So that's Proposition 5 that we talked about for California homeowners age 55 and up who have a lower property tax basis under Prop 13. They would be able to keep that going forward with as many different purchases as they make of homes after age 55. Proposition 6 would repeal the gas tax here in California. This gas tax that was passed by the legislature to fund infrastructure, roads, streets, and now you've got this measure which would repeal it. Those who say that it's made gasoline prices too high, argument of some is that the state of California should come up with, from its own budget, with the money to do this kind of work. Katie, do you want to start us on this one? Because this also has a ripple effect, Republicans are hoping, on statewide office seekers.
Yeah, this is a measure that Republicans are really hoping will get their voters out to the polls. You see a lot of Republican candidates. Gubernatorial candidate John Cox is really linking his campaign to this. You see a lot of the congressional candidates linking their campaigns to it. What we have seen, though, is that the donations for this proposition really peaked around the primaries and got people out. But however, they've kind of dropped off in the general election. So the ballot proposition is not getting as much support financially from Republicans as it had in the primary. However, you are starting to see ads coming out against it. There's a big coalition of groups, labor, cities, counties, government officials who are opposed to this proposition, and recent polls show it pretty far down.
All right. Melody.
Yeah, I'm just piggybacking on the polls. I think even your description of this ballot measure goes into the point that the proponents of this are saying, which is you would not know this is a repeal on gas taxes by reading the summary of it, which is eliminate certain road repair and transportation funding. That's become a huge part of the campaign and a lot of grumbling by the proponents of this who say that this was on purpose by the state to try to get this to pass. And I think you're seeing that in the polling numbers that essentially people are reading that and saying, well, I don't want that. But do they know essentially that it's repealing the gas tax? Is sort of the issue.
Michael Alvarez at Caltech, you do a lot of work in Orange County to try and understand the electorate there. What's your sense of Prop 6 and whether it's galvanized voters?
I think the evidence was pretty strong that this issue and the recall election that went on in Orange County in the primary did mobilize many Republican voters to get out to vote. I think it was something, and it's also something that the Republican running for governor, John Cox, has been campaigning on. This is one of these kind of cynical attempts by politicians to use the initiative process in their electoral campaigns. And we've seen this in the past, and I know we'll see it in the future, because it's an effective tactic to get your voters out to the polls.
Yeah. Sal, you want to weigh in on Prop 6?
So the Southern California Newsgroup originally endorsed Senate Bill 1 when it was proposed last year. Because we recognize, and I recognize, and I think most of us can recognize, that it's important to have adequate funding to pay for maintaining and taking care of transportation infrastructure. That's quite important. The issue with Senate Bill 1 was, one, a matter of process. The gas and vehicle registration fee increases were rammed through the legislature relatively quickly in a process that involved $1 billion in giveaways to buy votes, essentially, from various legislators, including Sabrina Cervantes, Richard Roth in the Inland Empire and elsewhere. But there's also a matter of the fact is that the state of California, one, has a profound amount of money. In the last seven, eight years, the state budget has grown from $86 billion to nearly $140 billion. So it's not that the state doesn't have a significant influx of money coming in year after year after year. It's that the state does not prioritize its spending adequately. In a time where we are talking about something bizarre like the high-speed rail project, it's a nice idea, a fanciful idea, that's going to cost over $100 billion probably if it ever gets anywhere. Why is it that we're spending – why is it that we have this significant increase in revenue? Why is it that we have pipe dreams like the high-speed rail project on the agenda, and yet we need to have a brand-new source of funding for transportation infrastructure? That doesn't seem right to me. That seems like a money grab to help sustain an unsustainable fiscal trajectory.
Well, and Fernando Guerra, yeah. I've heard some people argue that it is a regressive tax because mm-hmm. – people who often, you know, can't afford housing closer to work, drive longer right. distances, have less fuel-efficient cars. They pay more.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the major issues I have with this initiative is not actually the repeal, but then it handcuffs the legislature and California government for any future use of fuel taxes. And just the same thing that has happened with Proposition 13, which has handcuffed California to be proactive on a variety of different issues, this will handcuff us for generations to come in dealing with our road repairs. So it's not just a repeal. It further says that you can't do anything without two-thirds vote. It is, again, horrendous public policy problems. I agree with Michael and with Katie that it is a Republican ploy, and Democrats have done this historically as well, using the initiative process. Fortunately, in the last couple of elections, it's kind of died down. This is basically the only initiative that's really being done by a political party like that, where we used to have like four or five every year. But, you know, Californians, we vote and love our taxes, man. Just in the last election, we voted all kinds, except don't tax our homes and don't tax our cars. That's the issue.
All right. Let's continue. That was Proposition 6, the repeal of the vehicle fee increases and the gas tax. Proposition 7 authorizes the California legislature to provide for permanent daylight saving time, but it would only happen if the federal government were to allow that. So this is a dependent proposition, so to speak. Katie, you want to start us on this one?
Well, as a relatively new mom, I feel like
it makes you an expert on this.
Yeah, the fewer time changes, the better. But I think you really laid it out. This is something that I feel like California has sort of had a fascination with. We saw it, there a bill in the legislature this year, and that allows for this vote. But you really laid it out. What does this proposition do? Not much. I mean, it lets the legislature vote on it. If the legislature approves it, the governor could. Then it lets Congress work on it, and I believe the president has to weigh in as well. So, I mean, it is the start of a step of a process, but it really isn't anything that you'll see happen anytime soon.
Anybody else with anything quick to add, Michael?
I just wanted to say, I think that this is we're already a couple steps in. As I recall the history of this, I believe that there have been the legislature's been interested in this in the past, and we're now at a point where they were waiting to see if other states were going to be interested in moving away from daylight savings time. And so I think the legislature is kind of hopeful that by getting the California voters to weigh in on this one and then they will act, that maybe that will lead to a larger group of states getting behind this effort.
And part of the challenge is our California Constitution, which is hundreds of pages long. We continue to put a lot of things in there, and this was decades ago that we did this. And so now we actually have to have you vote on it to allow the legislature and Congress to take action if it happens. So we're just asking you not to just give them permission in case there's a national trend to change this. By the way, the European Union and throughout the world, there's major discussion. And in Europe, they will change it next year that we're getting rid of this. And it's consistent throughout the world. And we just want to continue with it.
There are concerns, historically, I should say, there have been concerns in the agricultural community about this, and because of, you know, the darkness when kids would be going to school, things like that. But Katie, are you aware of any sort of organized opposition to full-time daylight saving time?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that would be interesting to see if it gets out of California and goes to the federal government. Where would everyone come down on it? I honestly don't know. I do know, I will say, I used to live in Indiana, which had three time zones and was incredibly confusing. So we're not as, we wouldn't be as bad as some places. But I don't know how the federal government would take to this.
Yeah, of course, our neighbor Arizona doesn't go on daylight saving time, so they have a permanent permanent time, but it's not daylight saving time. It's a standard time that they keep year-round. So once again, that is Proposition 7, which, if passed by voters, then would allow the legislature and the governor to take this up if the federal government were to make a move towards standardizing full-time daylight saving time. Proposition 8... would require dialysis clinics, kidney dialysis clinics, to issue refunds to private insurance companies for revenue that they take in that's more than 15% profit from the service that they provide. This is a very complicated measure. I've just led recently a full-on debate on this, and I'm still trying to get my head around the complexities of this. But part of the history is the effort of Service Employees International Union to organize the employees at the two biggest dialysis companies, the chains that are here in California. Michael, you want to start us off on this
one? You gave me the hardest
one. I was going to say,
Actually, you know, this one is...
I've known you the longest, I think. That's why I'm punishing you.
My evaluation of this is exactly what you just said, which is this one's incredibly complicated. I've waded through this a number of times, and it reads as if it's an attempt to again, lower the cost or make dialysis treatment more affordable. But I do understand that there's a little bit of politics behind it, which I wonder if some of my colleagues might want to talk about, because I'm not quite as aware of the politics.
Melody, do you have some info on this to share?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the lesser-known initiatives. No doubt you've heard the radio ads, because $120 million is being spent on this.
A lot of ads.
Mostly by the dialysis clinics, who have poured a lot of money. You know, you do have the backdrop of unionizing, and you have the backdrop of, you know, whether or not healthcare costs should be able to soar like they have been. And so there's a lot of in the background going on to this one, on top of the fact that it's just a very complicated measure.
So the proponents, their argument is that there would be a greater investment by these dialysis centers in patient care, because they're not going to want to pay these rebates to the private insurers for going above 15%. And since what they would pay their employees in the providing the services would count as expenses, that therefore they would be more likely to invest in that. Opponents say this might well lead to dialysis clinic closures. We'll continue on this proposition on our voter cram session. This is the 2018 Voter Cram Session, heard on public radio stations throughout California. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Pasadena. We're at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum. This hour is devoted to looking at the pros and cons of California's 11 ballot measures. We're taking these in numerical order. Again, in case you joined us right in the middle of this broadcast, you can visit the website kpcc.org, and you'll be able to click on the link and hear the entirety of the broadcast. Also, if you'd like to take part in social media conversation around any of the ballot measures that we're talking about in this broadcast, please just use the hashtag CADREAM. That stands for California Dream, CA Dream, which is the collaboration of nonprofit news organizations, public radio stations in the state, and of Cal Matters. Let me reintroduce our panelists joining us from the Southern California News Group, which publishes a variety of newspapers in Southern California, the interim opinion editor, Salvador Rodriguez. Also from the San Francisco Chronicle, political reporter Melody Gutierrez, Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez, Loyola Marymount professor of political science Fernando Guerra, and KQED San Francisco politics reporter Katie Orr. We were just talking going into our break about Proposition 8, which requires private insurers be given rebates by dialysis centers if they go more than 15% above their direct costs for providing patient care for kidney dialysis. Now, the price is much, much lower for those who are in Medicare. This really targets the reimbursements that private insurers are making. Fernando?
Yes, again, very complicated. There's a lot that I like in this initiative. There's a lot that I hate in this initiative. It's basically two interest groups who couldn't resolve this issue in their private negotiations. They took it to the state legislature. They couldn't resolve it there, so now they're bringing it to you, except that they are giving you emotional arguments, not all the facts, because it is very complicated, and it is somewhat emotional. And when that happens, oftentimes we tend to vote no when we don't clearly understand it. To throw in some even more criticisms, not criticisms, but complexity is what you just mentioned, Larry, that I think it actually undermines the current situation, undermines the Affordable Care Act, and this would resolve some of that because it costs so much for insurers to cover dialysis that they don't want the pre-existing condition. So it plays into all of those national politics.
Salvador, you want to share any thoughts about this Proposition 8?
Sure. So, I mean, I don't know how many people here in the room are experts on the dialysis market. Something tells me there's not very many of us.
I wouldn't be surprised if there is someone here, but go ahead.
So on the economics of the yeah. dialysis market, when you have a fight between special interest groups like this and you're talking about a proposal to regulate an industry and particular components of the of an industry, is that something that we really need to be doing as voters? Is that something to do? If you don't feel like you know exactly what is at stake, you probably should vote no. This is probably not what the force of law should be used for micromanaging things like this. This is an abuse of the proposition process and an abuse of law.
All right, that's Proposition 8 requiring rebates from kidney dialysis centers to private insurers if they go above 15% margin on providing that service. Proposition 9 doesn't exist anymore. It would have carved California into three separate states. And the state Supreme Court said this proposition as written is not eligible to be on the California ballot. So no Proposition 9.
It doesn't mean we won't see it again in the future.
Oh, I'm sure we will see it again. It may not be three separate states.
Yes, okay.
Who knows how many states may be involved. So next up is Proposition 10. Now, this is the rent control measure you've heard a lot about. It repeals what's known as Costa-Hawkins, which puts limits on rent control measures that cities and counties can put on for unincorporated areas. So this means that newer construction would be covered by rent control. Melody?
Sure. One of the biggest areas that this would address is that single-family homes and condos could come under rent control. That's something that Costa-Hawkins says that cities could not pass. So this doesn't create rent control in these cities. This actually gives cities the options to expand the type of rent control that they have. Obviously, there's a backdrop of a housing market where people cannot afford to live in the communities in which they work or communities they've lived in for years. But surprisingly, it's not doing well in the polls. And I think that that's really interesting. It's not even doing well among renters. But there is an incredible heartbreaking story of people not being able to afford where they're at. But there's a lot of opposition arguments saying that if you create these availability of this kind of rent control, that essentially there won't be development, that developers will not build if they don't think that they can earn a profit.
There also is the argument that homes, single-family homes that are in the rental market, if those are rent-controlled, then fewer people are going to be willing to rent out those houses. Let's say they inherited it from mom or dad and they turned it into a rental, that it won't be as financially advantageous for them to rent it out, so those homes would be sold, not part of the rental stock. Katie, more thoughts on this?
Well, I just think it's interesting, especially considering that it's not doing well in the polls, because when they were considering this in the legislature this year, it was one of the most contentious issues up there. I mean, supporters of repealing Costa-Hawkins flooded the halls of the Capitol chanting, and when things didn't go their way, they were very upset. So it's interesting that there's a group of people who support it very, very passionately, but apparently it's not transferring to the rest of the voters.
Fernando Guerra.
I think of this just as a local control measure. All this does, it says, we give it back to the cities. And so California right now has one law that it's one size fits all for the entire state. But what we need in Pasadena or Santa Monica is different than what we might need in Anaheim or Laguna Niguel or San Diego. This, all it does, it doesn't institute rent control at all. What it does, it gives it back to the city councils to determine on a case-by-case basis. And that's so really, from my perspective, it's a local control. Let the locals decide what is best for their communities.
Salvador.
Yeah, so this absolutely is. It's about local control. It's about giving localities the control to be completely irrational and shoot themselves in the foot. Rent control.
Do you support that or not?
No.
So you'd rather be shot by California then?
Not quite, but now, you know, rent control is a beautiful idea. It's you know, the rents are too damn high, and so what better than to cap the rate of increase in rents? That's nice. Keep rents low. That's a fascinating idea. You pick up an introductory economics textbook. You go to page one. And there you will see why rent control is an absolutely absurd idea, that it will dramatically – it will significantly curtail housing production, housing affordability. It will have the opposite effect that proponents hope it will. It will be great for the people who get into rent-controlled units. It will be horrible for the vast number of people who never are able to get into a rent control unit, or never able to get into a new apartment or a new home that they can afford because the landlord pulled it from the market, or they converted it to a condo, or they did all kinds of different things to adjust.
Isn't this, though, similar to the argument over Prop 13 and particularly the proposition here, 5, in that there would be potentially fewer limits, if you accept that premise, fewer units that would be built. But for those individuals who might find themselves out on the street or would have to move a tremendous distance from their job or lose their job, that they would be protected. So if you make the argument that Prop 13 is good for older Californians because they're not displaced, why wouldn't that argument hold for rent control here?
So it'll be great for the people who are able to get – who are in a rent-controlled unit that is not then converted into a condo, or the people who are able to get into a rent-controlled unit that was built, or get into a unit that was built and that is affordable. But we're not – so there's the seen and the unseen in every policy decision. What we'll see are the people who are in rent-controlled units. What we won't see are all the homes that are not built. We're not going to see all the units that are not put on the market. We're not going to see we're not going to see the market work like it should. Now, obviously, we want to see – people will be able to afford to live in California. The way to do that is not to impose artificial limits like through rent control. Instead, let's try to facilitate more housing construction, more housing development, not do artificial games like this. Just open an economics textbook, look at page one.
Sal is right about the economics textbooks and what it says, but I hate to pick on my economic colleague because they're actually worse at prediction than we political scientists. And so everything that's written in economics books.
Which is saying something.
So it's not really an economic issue. It's what Larry was talking about. It could be a social justice issue and what kind of state we want to live in.
All right. Michael?
I'll go back to where I was talking about with respect to Props 1 and Props 2. I mean, what we're seeing here, I think, on the ballot, think about the ballot as a totality, is a lot of different efforts to try to grapple with this crisis of affordability in California. Here we're seeing an attempt to stabilize rents. In Props 1 and 2, we're seeing an effort to, you know, probably put a few drops in the bucket of trying to build more housing to try to deal with the supply side of the problem. So we clearly need to grapple with it on both sides. Stabilization, I see, is a really good short-term fix if cities want to move in that direction. But they really do need to be careful about how they do it and try to balance it with building more supply.
All right. Let's move on and talk about Proposition 11. This would allow the status quo where private ambulance drivers, emergency medical technicians would be able to be on call when they're taking their meals or other breaks. Because as I understand it, and our experts will correct me if I've got this wrong, but it seems under new state law, new interpretation, potentially they could not be on call with the change in interpretation of state law. This would enable them to be on call. Katie, you want to start on this one?
Sure. And right, like you were saying, in 2016, the Supreme Court ruled that private security guards, when they were on a break, they were on a break. They couldn't be on call or anything like that. And so the ambulance, primarily the private ambulance industry, saw this and decided that they feel like it's only a matter of time before a similar ruling is applied to them. So they're trying to get out ahead of this, basically carve out a piece of the labor law saying that their employees can still receive calls while they are on breaks. It's similar to Prop 8 in that it's a really specific industry issue.
And why wouldn't they be able to lobby the legislature to carry this through? I'm curious this ends up as an initiative.
They tried. That's what happened,
the legislature
right?
They didn't.
They went through the legislature, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a private dispute. They didn't solve it privately. They took it to the legislature. They didn't solve it there. Now they're asking you to do it. Mm-hmm. And so now remember, why do we even have private ambulance drivers? It's because a lot of cities, not like Pasadena or Los Angeles, where we have our own paramedics, they contract out. And so our paramedics here in Pasadena or Los Angeles don't fall under this. They can be on call because they're public safety officers. But in cities that contract these ambulance services, those EMTs and ambulance drivers are not considered public safety. Even though they're doing exactly the same job, it's because they're from the private sector. That creates a challenge.
Well, and I'm curious why the legislature, there wouldn't be sympathetic members of the legislature who would carry it on behalf of the private ambulance industry. It's interesting that that didn't go anywhere.
Well, you might have, I mean, labor groups might be opposed to that, you know, if you're carving out
slippery slope.
Right, and
yeah.
If you're carving out a part of the labor law, you know, yeah, it might not get far.
That's a logical argument that they'd be concerned, well, if they deal with ambulance drivers, then who might be next? That's Proposition 11. And are labor unions, do you know, Melody, have they come out against this or not? I don't think I've seen...
For some odd reason, I know that the California Teachers Association is against this.
Really?
Why? I don't know. I just read that somewhere.
Teachers are always on call, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's Proposition 11. The final measure on your California ballot is Proposition 12. Supporters of 12 say it is a natural extension of Proposition 2, which was passed a decade ago and put new space requirements on egg-laying hens, on pork, as well as on calves that are being raised for veal. And they say, the proponents of it, that this guarantees even more space for those animals than was in Proposition 2. The opponents of Proposition 2 say this is largely the work of a major egg supplier in California's Central Valley, and that they actually want to have smaller cages in which to have the egg-laying hens. Melody, do you want to start us on Prop 12?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a ballot measure that you would normally think that animal welfare groups would all jump on board, and they're not. And the argument is that the amount of space currently under law for says that an egg-laying hen has to be able to stand up, turn around, and lay down. Now, what does that constitute? Like, what is the exact specs of that cage in which a hen can do that, or a breeding pig, or a calf? And so this ballot measure essentially is creating those specs But animal welfare groups like PETA say, well, you know, we don't agree with that space, and that was never the intention of voters to give them that little of space. And so Humane Society says this is good. PETA and some other groups also say that are saying that this is going to give them actually less room and that you would be doing more for animals by not voting for this.
So and you have major environmental groups, Sierra Club's in favor of this, and I believe the Natural Resources Defense Council. But as you say, animal welfare organizations, there is a split. The Humane Society of the U.S., one of the big sponsors of this, as they were of Proposition 2, which was passed by California voters. Katie, anything to add on this?
Well, I think it is. It's one of those examples when it is a tricky measure. You know, I mean, you see this and you think, oh, you know, I feel like animals should have space. But then you get into the intricacies, and I think that's a lot of times the problem we have with governing by proposition, right? You don't know all the details that you really need to know.
Sal, your thoughts on Prop 12?
Yeah, so we're in a situation here with Prop 12 where the animal welfare groups can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare. You have some that say yes. You have others that say you have like PETA, that's very strongly against it. I would just humbly recommend that if there's a measure on the ballot that you can't wrap your head around, that even animal welfare groups, they can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare, perhaps vote no. Perhaps this can be resolved another way. Perhaps we can have a more deliberative process rather than have something as convoluted as this.
Well, I have to say, for all of us on the panel, I think, you know, all of us get asked a lot by friends and family members, what about this ballot proposition? What about that one? And so often, I just speaking for myself, I don't know about the rest of you, I have to say, you know, I've read about it, I've hosted debates on it, I've immersed myself on it, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around all the different moving pieces to it.
Yeah, Larry,
so many of these
are complicated.
You
should do what I do. I just tell every other person yes or no, and that way it balances out.
Just randomize.
And then you don't sack the deck. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate on this statewide broadcast. We appreciate your joining us. For our 2018 voter cram session, our panelists, Loyola Marymount, Professor of Political Science Fernando Guerra, KQED politics reporter Katie Orr, Southern California News Group interim opinion editor Salvador Rodriguez, San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Melody Gutierrez, and Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez. The 2018 voter cram session is part of the California Dream Project, a statewide media collaboration of KPBS, KQED, KPCC, Capital Public Radio, and the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. The project gets support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the James Irvine Foundation. Keep the discussion going on Twitter. Use the hashtag CADREAM for California Dream. For the 2018 voter cram session, I'm Larry Mantle of KPCC, Los Angeles.